May it please the court, I'm Richard Bossy, attorney on behalf of the appellants in this action, Joel Rabbi et al., and the corporate enterprises. As the court is aware, this is a family farm situation, and it's a very comprehensive farm that included over 1,700 acres and four elevators. And we are here today on our appeal in regards to Judge Timmerman's rulings of 19 and September 2018, finding that he would not amend the pleadings to assert additional claims, and a further ruling on 52.02 that the appellant was not granted leave or permission to move to amend his orders of the previous September.
Just to lay the groundwork for where we go from here, the only cause of action that Judge Timmerman allowed to go forward was one that you do not currently appeal.
That's absolutely correct. Yeah.
Thank you.
Absolutely correct. Yes. There were in the original, I call it the proposed second amended complaint, there were 11 counts which he dismissed, and there was a 12th count, I think it was, that was permitted to go forward. And then
dismissed later.
It on summary judgment.
Right, and has not been appealed.
Correct.
Okay, we don't need to bother with it anymore. I just wanted to make sure that I understand the lay of the land.
Okay. The only point I'd like to make in addition to that, Your Honor, is that the original dismissal was on a motion to dismiss on a Rule 12, and the latter is a motion for summary judgment.
Right. I have some questions on that subject for Respondents' Counsel and whether that really should have been a summary judgment motion as opposed to one to dismiss, but we'll get to that later.
Okay. Thank you. I would suggest to the court that in regards to the Rule 52.02, it appears, to this counsel at least, that there isn't much of an issue that under the Rathbun decision, we should have been permitted the opportunity to file and request a motion to amend the prior order. The judge's ruling was... Pardon?
You should have been allowed to amend the prior complaint.
Exactly correct. That's what I'm trying to say. Thank you, Your Honor. The court determined that, in effect, we could not bring that motion, that we were premature. But I think Rathbun pretty much clearly states that a motion under 52.02 can be brought on a summary judgment before a final judgment to amend that finding, and that's what we were attempting to do. As a matter of fact, I think the Supreme Court says in Rathbun, this is the most judicial, expeditious way of handling this matter. Okay. The second item, Your Honor, is good faith. There has been some argument that good faith is not a provision in our law for a contract. I want to reiterate to the court what's in our briefs, at least in this counsel's brief, and that is good faith is an obligation in every contract.
Can I ask you about this? Because, you know, we have the first release and the first forbearance agreement, and that did not include that good faith language.
Correct.
Am I correct?
Correct.
So actually, everything, that forbearance release that was reiterated had already been adopted by your client, right?
It had been under what we have alleged in the complaints as being a fraudulent inducement, okay, that he was promised that there was going to be good faith negotiations
global. So you're claiming there was an oral representation made that was a fraudulent inducement. But
correct.
But good faith was not part of that first forbearance.
Well, we suggest to the court good faith is always part of that original agreement because it's the law, and secondly, it was amended. Okay, it's an amended agreement. It all appears to be one. And in the amendment, the rabbis requested in there because respondents didn't adhere to it in the first agreement or what they understood to be the first agreement. So,
but the release agreement that that occurred first, that was identical to the release in the second agreement.
They're one and the same. Okay. I think word for word, Your Honor. Okay.
And you don't do you dispute? I mean, putting aside your fraudulent inducement argument, that that agreement basically would knock out all of your claims. Aren't you limited to your fraudulent inducement argument?
I would agree if it hadn't been amended. Once it becomes amended, I think it's all one agreement, and when you put that provision in there, it controls the parties at that point in time. Okay, that would be my argument. In addition to, and you've got it well in hand, and that is the fraudulent inducement argument, okay? And I think the fraudulent inducement argument I would suggest to you that it is a matter for the jury, okay? And I would suggest to you also that the provision placed in the second, the amendment, reinforces or is evidence of the fraudulent inducement in the first. And I think the court's well aware that fraud is normally only proved by circumstantial evidence.
Good faith provision in the supplemental agreement was to mediate in good faith, right?
Was to negotiate a global resolution,
right,
in good faith.
And then
towards the global resolution.
And then there was the litigation that resulted in Judge Trushinsky's determination that only a mediator can make that determination, and the mediator didn't make the determination of bad faith, and consequently he issued summary judgment in that earlier case.
I think that was Judge Trushinsky's ruling, but I think Judge Trushinsky's ruling relied more on the Dove affidavit, which we are challenging at this point in time and have the evidence that we suggest contradicts what Dove's affidavit said, that there were back and forth negotiations in the mediation.
I understand you have some other arguments. I just want to, as a foundational matter, establish whether or not you agree that Judge Trushinsky said only a mediator can make the bad faith finding and the mediator didn't make that finding.
Yes, and I think that can only be made, the mediator can make it and one of the parties can request the mediators to make it, and the respondents requested the bad faith against the appellants.
But it wasn't, the mediator didn't make that. You weren't the lawyer at the time, so I'm not suggesting wrong. That's not my point.
Oh, no, I'm not thinking that you are, Your Honor.
Okay, so then Judge Trushinsky makes that determination. And then there's an appeal of that, as I see the record. Is that correct?
I think there was an appeal that got dismissed as a result of the bankruptcy.
Right, but it was dismissed by the appeal was taken by the Rabbies.
Correct.
And then it was dismissed by I saw a stipulation. Too many papers here. There's a stipulation and an order. I think it was signed by Judge Matt Johnson at the time, dismissing that earlier appeal.
Correct.
So why is that determination of Judge Trushinsky not final on that question?
Because it's our suggestion, Your Honor, and our argument under Judge Trushinsky's ruling, specifically paragraph 16, that he found that there was negotiations, i.e., as in fact he picked up and paraphrased the Dove affidavit and referred to it, that there were proposals back and forth between the parties, and there never were, okay? And Dove filed an affidavit, and the court relied upon that affidavit in regards to that particular motion. Okay?
But that finding was made in a case that was appealed, and then the appeal was dismissed. Was there ever a motion to set aside the judgment in that case as fraudulently obtained?
The one's pending right now, Your Honor.
Okay, but isn't that really, that gets me to where I need to be. Isn't that really the only way to attack that is not by direct appeal in a different case, but rather by going back to the district court and saying that that judgment was obtained by fraud?
I don't argue with you on that. And that's the reason I filed. We filed in this particular case because it was the immediate case that the decision had been made on, and Judge Timmerman had relied upon paragraph 16 of Judge Trushinsky's order.
Judge Timmerman is in no better position than we are to set aside a final judgment from a different court, right?
We get into that argument. Is there concurrent jurisdictions between the district courts?
Of us were on the district court, and I'm guessing that we would have been very disinclined to set aside a final judgment of a different district court.
I would agree with you on that, okay, because I think there's also the doctrine of independent tribunals. I think there's concurrent jurisdiction, but I think there's a doctrine of independent tribunals that says the district courts do operate independently and that their particular orders ought to remain.
Also, comity.
Great word, Your Honor. Thank you.
And as a practical matter, we really can't have 287, I think, currently, district judges making orders about other judges' cases. They have to go back to the court.
I would agree with you on that, Your Honor. We took this action in this case because it was pending and we wanted to preserve our appellate rights. And I would suggest you are correct, but as far as this case is concerned, Judge Timmerman has made a ruling, and we would suggest that because he's based it on Judge Trzynski's, we're entitled to have that.
Absolutely.
Reversed.
There's no question the case is properly before us. I don't doubt that. But the question is, how do we dispose of that case? And in that regard, I think you have a bit of a problem.
I understand. I appreciate what you're saying. But I would suggest to you that because Judge Timmerman has assumed jurisdiction and based a decision and made a decision based upon Judge Trzynski's order and included in his decision, that we have the right to attack and bring that to this court and question what he's done based upon that, based upon the fraud, as we are claiming, through the Dove affidavit, which was instituted on Judge Trzynski. And we brought this fraud in front of Judge Timmerman, and he has, this whole case is really, he's avoided to make that decision on a procedural matter that we weren't permitted to bring a 52.02 action before there's a final judgment, basically. Okay. And that's basically why we're here, period, okay? Where I was going is I wanted to suggest that, you know, there is, I don't think there's any argument either that there's good faith. We have a civil jig that says contracts have to be operated on in good faith. Agreements, this court has made a decision in Outland Outland Renewable Energy versus Siemens that agreements to negotiate are agreements in this state, okay?
And I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I want to get back to something that Judge Rodenberg was alluding to. I just want to get an idea globally, you know, a 10,000-foot view of the landscape. So we have this appeal now going on. And you also have another motion in front of Judge Trzynski going on?
We have filed a lawsuit and amended. As a matter of fact, we have a hearing on a motion to dismiss next Thursday in regards to a Rule 60 motion to set aside, okay, and also a common law action for fraud based upon the affidavit.
And are there any other suits going on? Those are the two actions that are currently active?
There are several other actions that are currently active. I'm not involved in those actions, so I really hate to speak to those, in all fairness, okay? So very simply, the good faith is in the contract, and you can negotiate the contract for good faith, okay?
But again, looking at our role as a reviewing court,
yes.
And we have as an undisputed fact in this case that a district court judge has found that there was good faith. How can we, as a reviewing court, an error-correcting court, find that there was that finding isn't controlling in this case, and you are collaterally stopped from arguing? Otherwise?
And I don't mean to repeat myself, Your Honor, but it's the same argument I've been making. That is, Judge Timmerman accepted this case and made a decision based upon the finding of Judge Trzynski, and so therefore he's assumed and assimilated that, I'd suggest to the court. And therefore, I think we're permitted to attack what he has done because he has made issues and he has discharged list pendants which negate our rights on the property. And if the rights are negated on the property, my clients most likely won't receive any remuneration even if we're successful in either one of these litigations. So, you know, there are other elements out there for that make this important. And a crucial matter is there's list pendants on the property that Judge Timmerman has discharged, right? And that's now on appeal also. But if those properties get sold to BFPs, then we have no relief. Very simply.
Thank you, and you'll have.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I'm asking the presiding judge for a couple minutes. With about 1 minute left in your argument, I rub my eye, and I only have one contact right now, so I need to see if I can. The only thing worse than losing my eyesight is when my hearing aid battery wears out. I'll either get another contact in there,
we'll
or I won't.
Stand down.
Do you want to take a little break? I think you had 13 seconds left. How about if we tag that on to your 5 minutes? So 5 minutes and 13 seconds. Okay. And so then maybe respondents can get ready while Judge Rodenberg's getting ready.
Sorry about that.
Okay, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court and counsel. My name is Dustin Cross, and I'm representing Farmers State Bank of Trimont, as well as Mike Mulder and Robert Connors. I think the court has kind of tried to hit the nail on the head when it recognizes the serial nature of this litigation has gone on and on and on. What we're down to and what we need to remember is the forbearance agreements were separated in time by almost 10 months. The first forbearance agreement was in August of 14. The second was in June of 15. Both contained general, broad, and complete releases that were effective immediately. There is really no evidence or any suggestion of what good faith violation occurred as a result to breach the first forbearance agreement. Even if we can take, for argument's sake, this notion that there's somehow a violation of the agreement to negotiate a global resolution that's contained in the amended forbearance agreement. We have to remember another thing, and a key point of the foreclosure action, it was settled. That case was dismissed by a stipulation signed by the Robbie's attorney.
At the Court of Appeals level?
At the Court of Appeals level, and then at the district court level as well.
Oh, was there a separate settlement there?
There was a stipulation of dismissal.
Is that in this record? That's a voluminous record.
No, I don't think it is, Your Honor, but it's certainly a court record, and I think you alluded to, is this properly a Rule 12 or a Rule 56 summary judgment motion?
Do you want to jump to that subject?
Sure.
I'm not really sure about that. It seems like if there was a release in the earlier case that contained a good faith mediation or negotiation provision, and then there's a determination in that case that there's not been the requisite finding by the mediator of failure to good faith mediate and resulted in dismissal, and then that outcome should bind here seems more like a Rule 56 motion than a Rule 12 motion.
I'm not sure I'm following that argument, Your Honor.
It's not really an argument, it's a question. If your motion to dismiss was in large part based upon res judicata in the earlier action, correct?
It's based on the validity of the releases contained in the forbearance agreements, which were attached to the complaint and therefore incorporated therein under the rules.
Correct, but doesn't
which were initially alleged to be valid. I mean, if you look at the first complaint in this action, they don't allege this fraud claim; they allege that the agreements were valid.
Correct.
As they did in the bankruptcy.
It may not amount to any difference, really, because I think we're reviewing either a Rule 12 dismissal or a Rule 56 summary judgment de novo. So I'm not really sure that it makes a difference in the end, but it seems to me like your motion was more of a Rule 56 motion.
I mean, I don't agree, Your Honor, because we didn't introduce any additional evidence beyond what was in the public record, which the courts have recognized are properly considered.
Well, does the consideration of the prior foreclosure action and the findings that were made in that action, is that consideration enough to convert a Rule 12 motion into a Rule 56 motion?
No, Your Honor, I don't think it is. It's just like if you read a prior Supreme Court decision, do I need to, you know, I mean, back in the way, way long ago, you used to have to prove up laws and statutes and court decisions. We've long since dispensed with that and recognized that prior court decisions are considered public record. I don't know if it's considered judicial notice, but we don't need to use affidavits and things of that nature to convert it into a summary judgment motion.
All right. So it's your position that this is strictly a Rule 12 motion?
Yes. That's the way Judge Timmerman looked at it.
Rule 12 motion.
Yes, and he accepted all of the facts pled as true. In fact, he recited all of those facts as true and accepted the allegations of the facts, not the legal conclusions, of course. Now, the other thing I want to make sure I touch on, because I think it's critical, is this whole good faith argument and the characterization of Judge Trushensky's decision in the foreclosure action back in 2016. You can read Judge Trushensky's, it's part of our addendum decision, and in there you will see he's not relying on the so-called, the Dove affidavit. He has made the decision and determination that, number one, and this isn't challenged, that we participated in farmer lender mediation as we were required to do, and number two, the statute, fairly read, and as has been held by a published decision of this court, requires that the bad faith determination be made by the mediator upon request of either party or upon its own determination. That did not happen.
There was no request nor any finding.
Correct. And therefore, as a matter of law, we were in good faith. Now, what they're referring to, what Mr. Dove was referring to, it's a gross mischaracterization of a bar-admitted attorney, and it's frankly just wrong. What Mr. Dove was doing, he described the entirety of the negotiations between the parties, not simply the last negotiation on September 2nd of 2015. All of these affidavits that have been submitted post hoc, and I mean, the people that are trying to convert this into a summary judgment motion are the Robbies, not us. They tried to submit affidavits and supplement the record in an attempt, as they have been repeatedly, to bar and prevent my client from marketing this property. That's what this is all about. And they've been successful at it now for 3 years. They filed a frivolous right of first refusal claim that was dismissed by this district court, affirmed by this court, and petition for review was denied. That claim still includes a slander of title claim by my clients against the Robbies. Okay.
In the
right of first refusal action. So, Your Honor, and Mr. Bossi has conceded, number one, the forbearance, there's no action or conduct that's alleged that is on appeal today that post-dated the first forbearance agreement. So whatever argument we have about the contractual language in the amended forbearance agreement is irrelevant. This idea that somehow that release got modified, once it's released, it's gone. It doesn't get resurrected. So the first forbearance agreement, he recognizes there are no factual occurrences or events that form the basis of their claim that occurred between the date of the first forbearance agreement and the second forbearance agreement, such that we need to rely on the second release in the amended forbearance agreement. He recognizes that. He also recognizes...
Well, except he's arguing, though, that first one goes away because of fraudulent misrepresentation.
But if I release something today, how can I reinstate it tomorrow? I mean, there's nothing in the amended forbearance agreement where the bank said, oh, by the way, if you have claims that you want to bring us against us, go ahead now. We'll resurrect them. In fact, there's another release. The exact same release is in both forbearance agreements. Remember, this is negotiated by counsel. I mean, Robbies were not pro se. This was negotiated at arm's length. In addition to that, it has any number of warranties and representations by the Robbies that they have no defenses. they have no counterclaims, that all of the loan documents are true and correct, and as we know, under 513.33, the idea that an oral representation can modify or restrict the scope of a written agreement is not allowed as a matter of substantive law. For this very reason, this is exactly the case that back in the 1980s caused the legislature to enact that statute. So if the court doesn't have any more questions, I'll turn
it over. Do you agree with, apparently there is this other action to go back and set aside the judgment in the other case?
Well, it's an independent action.
Okay, but there's some other court proceeding going on.
Yes.
Do you agree with my kind of assessment of where we're at as regards that whole question? That is, that's really for the district court to resolve rather than us in an appeal of a different case.
Yes, I agree with that, Your Honor, but I would also say that action is, there's any number of problems with the arguments in that action.
I'm not making any attempt to judge the merits of that other action. I'm just, it's my observation, or my thought, that that's the appropriate forum within which those determinations should be made, not this one.
I think that the forbearance agreement is valid as a matter of law, and it will be shown to be valid as a matter of law under any forum. But my point is, I don't want to kick the ball down the road any further.
No, I understand.
I don't want to invite the Robbies to start yet another lawsuit.
I understand that, but I also don't want to wander out of our proper lane of travel here. When we've got an appeal of the judgment in this case, it seems like we ought to confine our determination to what's going on in this case.
Sure.
And leave for some other day.
Sure.
Whatever happens in the other cases.
In this case, the proper question to ask is, are the forbearance agreements, the release contained in the forbearance agreements, is it a valid contract? And the answer to that question is undeniably yes. And then stop. The issue of this whole, and you know, read Judge Drzezinski's foreclosure decision. He's not relying on Mr. Dove's affidavit. He's relying on the proper legal conclusion that mediation occurred and it didn't succeed. And what Mr. Bossi's trying to conflate, and the problem I generally have with this whole good faith notion, is this idea that if I mediate, to be in good faith, I must compromise. I must give up. I must, you know, if you owe me $100,000, I'm not negotiating good faith unless I agree to accept 90. But that's not the law. The statute specifically provides it's not the law, nor should it be the law.
Right. I don't think anybody challenged, I don't at least challenge that idea that if I call up my credit card company and start negotiating with them over.
They have to give you some credit.
They don't have to knock anything off my bill.
Correct.
In fact, they'd be foolish to.
But following up with Judge Rodenberg's line of questioning, so it's really not within our purview to deal with whether this is newly discovered evidence of this email and all the other issues that were raised as part of this. I mean, truthfully, all that's before us in this record is that we have a decision by another district court judge.
Correct. That part I absolutely agree with. So I'm going to turn the roster over to my co-respondent for his reserve time if you have no further questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Phil Kaplan from the Anthony Oslin Law Firm, representing respondents First Financial Bank in Winnebago and William Erickson. The court should affirm the district court's decision to dismiss and reject all claims that appellants asserted against my clients, First Financial and Mr. Erickson. Mr. Cross addressed the releases and the forbearance agreements. We've also fully briefed that issue. I don't intend to discuss the releases right now. The reason that I wanted to reserve some time today to speak on behalf of my clients is that there are additional independent reasons why it was proper to dismiss my clients from the case, even absent
Erickson has been dropped. I was trying to figure out where Erickson is in this mix.
I've been trying to figure that out for over 2 years. So Mr. Erickson was sued. Then we moved to dismiss Mr. Erickson from the lawsuit. Then the appellants amended their complaint and did not name him as a defendant. So we went to court and we said, that's fine, they're no longer pursuing Mr. Erickson, but we want to make sure the dismissal is with prejudice, not without prejudice. And on the record, appellant's former counsel said, we have no objection to that. And then the court, in its dismissal order, wrote that on the record, appellants dropped Mr. Erickson. But somehow, he's now a respondent again. And he should not have.
Judgment of dismissal from when that happened?
Yes.
There is.
Yes. So Mr. Erickson was dismissed from the case in 2018, I believe it was, 2019. I'm losing track of how long this case has been pending. But yes, Mr. Erickson was
dismissed.
He's
incorporated into the final judgment dismissing all claims against all parties from which appeal is taken.
Correct. Okay. The reason that he's different from First Financial or any of the other defendants is that they voluntarily dismissed him with prejudice on the record. The second reason why, second independent reason why First Financial and Mr. Erickson were properly dismissed is that appellants failed to plead any valid claim against them.
The loan actually went through FSB, right?
Exactly. And that
contract was with FSB to participate.
Exactly. That's how our participation.
Talk to the Rabbies?
Yes, and that's the gist of their allegations against Mr. Erickson and First Financial are that Mr. Erickson sat in on two meetings with the appellant's accountant. He asked some questions, and at the end of the meetings, the accountant admitted that there were errors in appellant's financial records. That is the entirety of their story.
Was that after the participation agreement had already been in place?
Yes.
So, in other words, when the loan was made, at the time the loan was made, they hadn't even met each other.
As far as I know, that's correct.
From what the record shows.
Right. And it looks like I have about 4 seconds. I will conclude my remarks there. Thank you.
Thank you. Any rebuttal?
Yes.
Can we start with Mr. Erickson?
Yeah.
Do you have any objection to affirming his dismissal?
I just checked my heading, and I didn't sue Mr. Erickson in my third proposed amendment.
Right, but do the Rabbies even care?
They don't care. I don't
confirm the dismissal of Mr. Erickson and move to the
on behalf of Rabbies et al. I affirm the dismissal.
Thank you,
Judge. I am going to take issue with you on your credit card analogy for two reasons. Okay, first,
farmer lender mediation doesn't apply for one thing.
Yeah, well, that's true, too, okay? But this is a different situation in that we're talking about, I don't have $17.5 million on my credit card, okay?
No, neither do I.
Okay, and so that's, you know.
Even the black card doesn't give you that
much. I guess not, okay? But secondly, at the time, Rabbies were never in default. This was not a foreclosure based upon non-payment. This was a foreclosure based upon the bank declaring themselves uncomfortable with the loan. Okay, and I think that makes a big difference in the broader picture here when we're talking about negotiating in good faith, particularly negotiating in good faith to a global settlement when it comes to the fraud in the inducement on that first on the first forbearance agreement. And fraud in the inducement vitiates that contract. That's the law in Minnesota.
Well, can I ask you, because one thing I didn't understand, there was the first forbearance agreement. Was there a default of that first forbearance agreement?
No, there was no default. In fact, that's one of our contentions. Default was never, never made against us. The bank declared themselves uncomfortable with the loan, okay?
Then why was the need for the second forbearance agreement then?
because the bank under the first forbearance agreement obtained $1,232 acres
as additional security.
As additional security for no consideration except to extend for about 9 months a payment that was never in default.
Respondents argue that you didn't make the no consideration argument below.
Yes, we did. Yeah, all very thoroughly. Very thoroughly. In front of And so you don't misunderstand, Judge. In front of Judge Timmerman, we did, okay, in our motion, okay. That argument was never made before Judge Trzynski, I don't think, in the original, that I've seen in the record. So why,
I don't think you finished your answer to my question.
Maybe.
Why, what was the need for the second forbearance agreement then, if there was no default?
to extend this payment that they were requiring, okay? And the second forbearance agreement included, we're going to negotiate in good faith. So I would suggest that one offer and no in this atmosphere is not negotiating in good faith.
But now your clients were represented by Stinson Leonard Street at the time of these forbearance agreements, as I read the record.
That appears to be correct, Your Honor.
So they were represented by a...
They were represented by counsel. They were represented by counsel. I'm not going to argue that they were in there by themselves. Okay, okay. But the point being is that negotiations is more than mediation also, okay, particularly in a situation like this where the bank is claiming it's uncomfortable. Okay. The bank's never really sat down and said, this is why we're uncomfortable, and this is what we want to do to bring us back to comfort, which is what you would think the bank would do in this situation.
It seems they did that in May of 2014 when Erickson and that group determined that they had overstayed the value of their assets on the financial statements, which then made the risk much higher than the banks were comfortable with.
They just dictated that they were uncomfortable. They didn't dictate any alternatives. They didn't sit down and discuss any plans on how we're going to work this out. We're uncomfortable, and then we're going to move into the first forbearance agreement, and we're going to take, besides the 500 acres we have, now we're going to take 1,200 acres that we never had for an eight-month extension, which...
Well, can I ask you? I'm just looking at the bankruptcy order, and I want to. I'm referring to finding of fact number 14.
Okay, I don't have it memorized, John. So if
well,
you're mind.
And I'll just read it to you.
Okay.
And it says on June 19, 2015, defendants, which are your clients,
right,
entered into an amended forbearance agreement with plaintiff, which is the respondents here, or the respondent bank. In the amended agreement, defendants again agreed they had not made any payments on the amount due and had defaulted under the terms of the forbearance agreement and loan documents. Defendants reaffirmed indebtedness and claimed no defenses to the validity and enforceability of the loan documents and agreed to pay all reasonable fees, costs, and expenses incurred in enforcement of the amended agreement. That's the finding of fact. Now, and I think we've been discussing, don't we have to accept that finding of fact in this Rule 12 motion and in our review of this matter?
I would suggest not, because of the permeation here of the fraud in the inducement, which we have been talking about, Your Honor, because that original agreement was fraudulently induced,
but if that wasn't raised as an issue there, I mean, haven't you forfeited the issue there?
I don't know, Your Honor, because I'm not prepared to answer.
Because that would have been the time to raise it.
Yeah. I'm not prepared to answer that question if it was raised or not raised, okay? If it wasn't, I would suggest, well, first of all, we haven't discovered the fraud until recently because it's their own records which reflect that this was it. You know, one offer made by us and no, okay? It's not the back and forth offers that Mr. Dove, as Judge Trzynski relays, went back and forth for these negotiations.
Thank you. Your time is up and the case has been thoroughly briefed.
Your Honor, I know I'm sort of unusual, but counsel has misstated something that's, I think, very important in the record, and that is the default occurred, all payments were due on June 1st, 2014. All payments. That's the default.
We have that in the record.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We will be in recess. We have another matter that's going to be heard via ITV, and we'll get the TV set up. So,
all right.